SF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
There is a permanent Nakba. There is a permanent understanding that the Palestinians must either be removed from what is known by the Israelis as Judea and Samaria, the entire region on the western side of the Jordan River. Palestinians have to leave, they have to be expelled, that's one proposal. Or the second is that they remain, but they remain subordinated and as second-class citizens. That's the permanent Nakba. That is, in fact, what the Israeli authorities have wanted since 1948, and it has been unchanged.
That's Vijay Prashad. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad. Is the Nakba permanent? Nakba is Arabic for the 1948 catastrophe, where 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled and driven from their ancestral homes and lands. Today, 77 years later, the Nakba continues, this time aided and abetted by the United States. Israel declares it has, quote, the most moral army in the world, which does everything to avoid harming noncombatants, unquote. Watch Al Jazeera or read the reports from Amnesty International, B'Tselem or Gush Shalom, and other human rights organizations to verify the Israeli claim. Netanyahu has declared there will be no Palestinian state, and Israel will control Gaza. Will there ever be a viable Palestinian state? The key word is viable, not just a collection of Bantustans crisscrossed by Israeli-only roads, walls, barriers, and checkpoints. What will be the fate of millions of Palestinians? Is the Nakba permanent? Our guest today is Vijay Prashad. He's an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the executive director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. He was at his home in Santiago, Chile, when I talked with him in mid-May. Welcome to the program.
It's a great honor to be with you, David.
Isabel Allende is an acclaimed writer. She's a relative, incidentally, of Salvador Allende, the democratically elected president of Chile, who was overthrown in a CIA-sponsored coup in 1973. Isabel has lived in the United States now for many years. She wrote recently about fear, and that's what I want to talk to you about. She says, it's a very pervasive thing that changes a society and changes the way people behave with each other and changes you from inside. Something breaks inside you. That's a direct quote. Today, in the United States, there's a palpable climate of fear. Masha Gessen, in an op-ed, writes, quote, America's police state has arrived, unquote. People are being picked up off the street with no due process or habeas corpus. Their personal data is being stolen. They're being illegally detained and in some cases deported. Talk about fear, its uses, and crucially, how to overcome it.
You know, you can diminish people by fear and you can lift them up when you break the back of fear. Fear plays an enormously negative role for a culture. It's not just individual, you know, that you and I may individually be afraid of being picked up by a government, or we might individually fear, somebody targeting us one way or the other. In fact, when you see on a street a van stop and you see people get out of the van and pull somebody out of a car, throw them into the van and drive off, that corrodes all of society. That's not something that just happened to the person in the car. It's not just the person in the car that is afraid or their family. Everybody who sees that feels fear, feels uncertainty. They don't know what's going on. This corrodes the whole culture. It's not just, you know, even you and I who might see this in real time or even watch a video. It's everybody. If I tell somebody what I saw, they will also feel that their soul corrodes a little bit. So I think the experience of, say, a country like Chile, where fear really crept into the culture and has remained, you know, it hasn't been washed away as the democratic process has come. It remains in the culture. And then the experience of China, where a certain kind of rural fear was cast aside. There may be other kinds of fear people feel, but this rural fear of landlordism and so on was cast aside. You can both have fear imposed on you and you can set it aside. People should not feel that this is a permanent situation. You know, if you struggle against the conditions that impose fear on you, you can actually prevail. And I feel that, for me, David, is precisely the immense spirit of human beings. You know, our capacity to prevail over something like fear, which is a very, very ugly emotion if it sets into the whole culture.
You taught at Trinity College in Connecticut for many years. Now, from your vantage point in Chile, why is Trump going after elite universities like Columbia and Harvard? Students exercising the right of free speech and protest are being suspended and expelled. They're being accused of being anti-Semitic. They're being accused of harming U.S. national interests. Marco Rubio has called protesters lunatics, and he boasts that he has a list of targeted student activists who may have their visas revoked. As a former college professor in the U.S., comment on this situation and the importance of academic freedom.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say is that the U.S. far right has for a long time seen colleges, I suppose accurately, as a reservoir of resistance to right-wing activity, resistance also to right-wing thought. This is not a new thing. The attack on, say, multiculturalism, the attack on ethnic studies in Arizona and so on, that part of it is actually quite old. This attempt to subordinate various forms of thought in the academy. I mean, I taught at Trinity on several occasions the Anti-Defamation League, which is not a conventionally far-right organization, would show up on the campus, talk to the president and say that I should be removed from this or that post. In fact, one of the reasons I left the college was I found it exhausting to be constantly under surveillance by these sort of Zionist organizations and right-wing organizations. You know, the right has long decided that college professors and colleges themselves are the reservoir of sort of anti-right-wing discourse. Well, what is new now is the fact that they were proven right. The right was correct that during this genocide in Palestine, tens of thousands of students in U.S. colleges participated in rallies, in boycotts, in you know, sit-ins, in occupations of colleges. And they were saying, stop the genocide. And so now you bring together an older animosity towards college professors who are teaching ethnic studies and this, that, and the other thing. You bring that antipathy together with a way to try and shut down this protest movement against the genocide in Gaza, and you've got this the perfect opportunity. And that's exactly what's happening. I mean, they're not just arresting student radicals, you know, Palestinians and also non-Palestinians on colleges to shut the protest down. In fact, they're going beyond that. They're talking about diversity, equity, and so on, that all of these programs have to be closed down. That's their earlier anxiety, and they're bringing the two together. I mean, I would like to say that on this, the right wing is actually correct. It is true that universities resisted the rise of the right in a very clear and focused way. Many places did, not everywhere, many places. And it's also true that on U.S. college campuses, The left has a space to operate. The left-wing professors can get jobs, and if they are courageous, they can speak their mind. You know, this is actually true. And the right-wing has decided we are going to shut this down. This has enormous implications for the idea of free speech. But, you know, I would say that people who lack the courage to defend freedom of speech have always been there on U.S. campuses. It's not the first time that this has happened. During the 1950s, during the McCarthyism period, college professors of the left, some communists, some non-communists, some our friends, in a slightly later period, Howard Zinn, for instance, had a hard time getting a job. You know, Noam Chomsky, our friend, has said at many occasions, written about it, said it was easier to be in the sciences because they sort of needed you to teach science, but it was harder in the humanities. They went after a whole generation of people then, and liberal professors didn't defend them. That was the case of the 1950s, you know, and it wasn't just communists. It was gay professors, the so-called Lavender Menace at Smith College, where professors were being fired for being gay. Nobody defended them. I mean, that's the scandal of this, David, that where are the liberals? When are they going to be outraged on the campus to defend students, to defend their own presidents, you know, who from the very beginning were being run out of town? And by the way, the attack on college presidents preceded the attack on the colleges and the money. And who defended these presidents? Nobody. You don't defend against the first attack. You're vulnerable to lose every single one of them.
Among those groups monitoring the academy would be Campus Watch, Beter, and the Canary Mission. May 15th marked the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe. It refers to the forced expulsion and ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians from their homes and lands in 1948. Here we are, 77 years later, with Palestinians enduring another Nakba. The organization Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East says the Nakba never ended. We've run out of words to describe the horror that is Gaza and increasingly the West Bank. Genocide is being live streamed as the so-called civilized world watches. Israel's war on Gaza persists unabated, aided and abetted with U.S. weapons and tax dollars and diplomatic cover in international fora. Amnesty International, in its annual State of the World's Human Rights Report, writes, Israel committed genocide in Gaza, including by causing some of the highest known death tolls among children, journalists, and health and humanitarian workers of any recent conflict in the world, and deliberately inflicting on Palestinians conditions calculated to bring about their physical destruction. There was very little coverage of the Amnesty report. One can only imagine if the report was on Iran or Russia, let's say, what the response would be. Your comments.
Obviously, David, you know, it's been sickening just to watch this particular bombardment of Gaza. I mean, you know, you and I have observed and reported on and tracked the violence inflicted on the Palestinians for a very long time, but I would say that this is qualitatively different. This is just really brutal. You know, there is a permanent Nakba. There is a permanent understanding that the Palestinians must either be removed from what is known by the Israelis as Judea and Samaria, the entire region on the western side of the Jordan River, going all the way to Egypt. In fact, some Israelis want to go beyond the Jordan River into Jordan, but even further to Iraq. I've seen a map now showing Israel claiming the whole of Jordan. At any rate, Ilyas said, one, Palestinians have to leave. They have to be expelled. That's one proposal. Or the second is that they remain, but they remain subordinated and as second-class citizens. That's the permanent Nakba. That is, in fact, what the Israeli authorities have wanted since 1948, and it has been unchanged. I mean, you know, we should not underestimate what the Israelis have been doing on the West Bank during this period. Again, coming in, bulldozing houses and so on. They've actually, by now, effectively taken over Jerusalem. And so, given this, this permanent Nakba situation, my opinion, and I know what you were saying about, you know, Russia or Iran, if the Amnesty report had been about those regions, this is not just about geopolitics. This is also reflective of an international division of humanity. You know, some people are seen as human and some people are not. You know, the Ukrainians are given title to full humanity, Palestinians not. They are not seen as human. And I think this is a very old colonial understanding of the world, this international division of humanity. Some people human, some people not human.
The Israeli attitude seems to be toward the Palestinians, let them go somewhere else. The Israeli outlet Maariv in mid-May reports Netanyahu saying about Gaza, I'm quoting here, "We are demolishing more and more homes. They have nowhere to return to. The only natural outcome will be a desire among Gazans to emigrate. Our main problem," Netanyahu is quoted, is saying, "is finding countries willing to take them," unquote. That kind of lays out the grand strategy that the Israeli government has for the Palestinians. You know, during the post-George Floyd uprisings in the United States, there was the slogan, Black Lives Matter. Do Palestinian lives matter? You seem to suggest that they don't in the kind of configuration of power.
Well, the first thing, I mean, I think needs to be said, even though it may be obvious to many of your listeners, is that what Mr. Netanyahu says is a war crime. Just what he said, you know, in that quotation. This idea that you forcibly remove people, displace people, is a war crime. Let me explain that for a minute. Firstly, it is settled international law that Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem are part of the occupied Palestinian territory. This happened in 1967. It's settled international law. That's why in international documents, these areas are referred to as the occupied Palestinian territory. It is also established international law that when a military power occupies a territory, they cannot transfer population. In the Geneva Conventions, that is called population transfer. Population transfer is a war crime. What Mr. Netanyahu has just said is he says that we are creating the conditions for population transfer in an occupied territory. Just for that, he needs to go to prison. Just for that statement. I mean, you don't need any more. That statement plus the behavior of the Israeli state bulldozing northern Gaza demonstrates an active war crime. We are seeing a war crime in real time. Are Palestinians treated as humans? Of course not. Of course not. By whom? I mean, in the United States, young Palestinian students stand up and say, I think what's happening in Palestine is outrageous. Some of them go to prison. In Israel, a Palestinian posts on Facebook, a Palestinian who lives within the 1948 lines in Israel, a Palestinian posts on Facebook, I am outraged by the violence against Palestinians in Gaza. They are arrested and sent to jail. There's a number of examples of this. That means that neither in the United States nor in Israel are Palestinians seen as human beings, because you cannot say that Palestinians are being treated as less than human. How can you say they are being treated as less than human if they are not less than human? You know, this may sound like some sort of philosophical gobbledygook to somebody, but trust me, give me a whiteboard or a blackboard, I can diagram this for you. The logic of arresting a person, anybody, in fact, not just a Palestinian, but even worse if it's a Palestinian, for saying that Palestinians are being treated as less than human is a sign that you don't believe that they are less than human.
To what extent does Islamophobia and Orientalism factor in how Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, the East writ large are seen? Though when it comes to money-loaded feudal sheikhs, sultans, and emirs, there's no shortage of admiration and adulation from the Trump regime.
I actually have been reconsidering some of these concepts, Islamophobia and Orientalism. And I think it's okay to reconsider them. I think Edward Said, who you and I both knew, would say, well, let's have a conversation about it. I don't think he would be upset by it. I'm reconsidering it, and your question also suggests that you're thinking about it. Because I think that more than a fear of Islam or more than hatred of the East, there is certainly in the world we live in now a deep hatred of anybody who's standing up or trying to change the world order where the West used to be dominant. As the West is slipping from a position of almost absolute power, it is lashing out against anybody who is not willing to subordinate themselves to the West. Very interesting. The Prime Minister of Italy, Maloney, traveled to Albania. And the Albanian head of government, I've forgotten whether he's the Prime Minister or the President, got down on one knee to greet her. And I thought, oh, that's so perfect. You know, the East subordinating itself to the West. As long as you subordinate yourself, you drop to your knee. You know, he was there like as if he was asking her to marry him or a knight waiting to be knighted. You know, utter subordination, submission to power. Unless you submit to power, like, you know, the Arab regimes have been doing. Mr. Trump, please take this aircraft. It's a gift from us, the Qataris say. I mean, it's a ridiculous attempt at currying favor. Unless you do that, then we hate you. We hate the Chinese. Why? Why does the West hate the Chinese? Because the Chinese are saying, look, we're not going to bend our knee to you. You know, we are not going to surrender our development growth. You're going to sanction us. Well, okay, go ahead and put tariffs. We're going to build our own thing. We'll trade with somebody else. They hate the Palestinians because the Palestinians say, we are not going to subordinate ourselves to Israeli power. We want to build our own world. You know, they hate the Cubans because the Cubans say, we are not going to subordinate ourselves. Venezuelans, we're not going to subordinate ourselves. All these people that effectively say we want to build sovereignty, and now they are joined by the Burkinabe people in Burkina Faso. They are joined by the Malians, by the people of Niger, all saying we want to build our own world. We don't want to subordinate ourselves. Well, look, here come the coup d'etats. I mean, you are going to face violence as if you don't get on your knees. Except the problem is, the West no longer has the capacity to permanently put down the million mutinies. And there are a million mutinies now. There are. They just can't put them down. You know, they can't. Because it's like whack-a-mole. You whack somebody here, somebody else appears. Why? Because the world is changing. Western power is no longer going to be eternal or feel like it's eternal. And so, yeah, I think that it's true that Islamophobia is real and it does exist in many places, including within the United States. But I just don't think this is the best lens to understand what's happening either in Palestine or, you know, against the Chinese, against the Burkinabe people. I just don't think this lens effectively gets it. I think the stronger lens is that the West is declining and it's unwilling and unable to accept countries exercising their sovereignty.
The Gaza genocide has created some openings, some apertures. Automatic support for Israeli policies simply ain't what it used to be. There have been demonstrations across the U.S., Canada, and around the world, maybe even in Chile, which has a large Palestinian diaspora and population. Diaspora Jewish organizations such as Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, and other groups have not only participated, but have led protests. Within Israel, there's B'Tselem, Standing Together, and Breaking the Silence, The latter is an organization of former soldiers against the Gaza war. Its director, Avner Gevaryahu, has said Netanyahu's government is drunk on revenge. Another dissident voice inside Israel is Ami Ayalon, former Israeli Navy Commander-in-Chief, director of Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence service. He warned, quoting, "Continuing the occupation is the single greatest threat to Israel's safety and to our existence as a democracy." He predicted that Israel's continued settlement expansion and preventing an independent Palestinian state, I'm quoting again, will isolate Israel, increase anti-Semitism, and be the end of Israel as the founding fathers of Zionism envisioned it, unquote. So there is, you know, rising animosity toward what Israeli state policies are.
Yes, that's true. But I'm not sure if I want to accept this as a major change. You know, ever since the 67 war, there has been a current within Israel that has been very much opposed to militarism, to the militarization of Israel, in fact. There's been a current. There have been lots of liberal voices that have been there, you know, for a very long time. I'm not sure that they have the kind of impact that they need to have. And I think that's a problem. I think that the settler movement, for instance, the settlers in the West Bank, the settlers who want to go back and resettle Gaza and so on, I think they have an enormous megaphone. I think that, the new right that has emerged in Israel, made of people who've migrated there over the last 20 years or so, this is not the old Ashkenazi elite, you know, which incubated a kind of liberalism, a kind of sort of, you know, European civilization liberalism. This is not that crowd. These are people with different obligations, different ideas. You know, they, when they came into Israel from Russia and other places, they went straight into the settlements, many of them, and that's their worldview. And those settler parties, I think, have an enormous role to play in the Knesset, in Israeli culture. So I don't feel too confident that within Israel there can be a new dispensation breaking out. I just don't see it. I mean, all the people who emerge as an opposition to Mr. Netanyahu end up actually being, you know, party to one or the other conflict. I mean, look at the cabinet that was set up after October 7th. Everybody sort of joined in, you know, and even when they broke away saying he's conducting the war badly. You know, that was the general sense of people who broke from Netanyahu. They said he's doing the war badly. Not that this war is objectionable. There are lots of good voices of conscience. I don't want to minimize that. And it's extremely important to have these voices of conscience within Israel. But I also don't want to exaggerate their role in Israeli society. I think that would be an error for us. Now, when you talk about the world and the protests going on around the world, one of the things that's important to recognize that in some countries, in Turkey, in Indonesia and so on, they see this as part of Muslim solidarity. So there's a kind of limited, you know, understanding of the Palestinian struggle, national liberation and so on. But still, millions of people out on the street. I think I would like to register the fact that still within the non-aligned movement, even in the BRICS bloc, and this has had an impact on the right-wing government in India, in the BRICS bloc as well, some old ideas of Palestine as a unfinished anti-colonial struggle resonate. I mean, just in mid-May of this year, the Chinese foreign ministry said that, you know, Gaza is part of Palestine, it should not be touched, and so on. The fact that the BRICS has taken a position which emanates from the residues of the kind of, you know, anti-colonial view of this struggle has actually hampered Mr. Modi in India. Mr. Modi hasn't been able to fly to Tel Aviv and stand with his friend Netanyahu. Mr. Modi hasn't been able to say, you know, that India is with Israel. Mr. Modi himself has not been able to do that. Equally, even though the Indian businesses have been selling weapons continually to Israel right through this conflict,